Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing series on alternative health issues, examining issues from around the world that generally do not make it into the mainstream media and hence into our conscious, yet are very important. As I'll be reading and quoting these verbatim, I'll also be doing short commentaries to give you what I consider the important part of the story that we could pay attention to and resources. Later on, time permitting, I will also go to calls. I'm going to ask our engineer in our New York City studio, Michael, what that number will be for people who would like to join us in this forum and call in with comments or questions about the issues that will be discussed today. Michael, what would be that number that people could call us on?
That number is 212-209-2900.
All right. And as you call in, Michael will be taking the calls, and it'll be about 20 minutes and I'll hopefully get to calls today. Let's begin by something that's been going on for years, and that is the controversy around chelation therapy. Chelation therapy has had no less than 12 books written on it, dozens of articles in the science and lay presses, at least in the last 2 years. I've written two articles on chelation and one a white paper on it. I've done probably close to all 30 radio broadcasts on it. And yet, it is still denied for insurance coverage by most companies. It is still badmouthed by most of the orthodox clinicians. Interestingly enough, a very disproportionate number of people getting the therapy are physicians as a profession. In fact, almost every time I went into one recent, let's say 2 week period, I was in a doctor's office because I was working on some protocols with him. He had a drip room of about 15 chairs. There was always one or two physicians being dripped. And yet these are people who benefited, but don't always get that word out. So then with that as background, there was an effort to determine once and for all if chelation therapy really has efficacy and safety. And it was called the Calgary Chelation Trial, up in Calgary, Canada, at the University of Calgary. And they've just presented the results of a clinical trial of chelation carried out at Calgary Foothills Hospital at a cardiology meeting in Orlando, Florida. The results, to be published in a few months, showed that chelation therapy, quote, showed no benefit, unquote. The treatment regimen consisted of two treatments a week for 15 weeks and one a week for 3 months afterwards. The 80 patients were followed after that for 6 months. 40 received this treatment, 40 received a placebo IV. The protocol was allegedly designed with the assistance of the American College for the Advancement of Medicine. That actually didn't happen, but that's what they allege. Based on a number of measures, Dr. George Weiss, who attended the Orlando meeting, said, quote, there was absolutely no difference between the two groups, meaning those who got the placebo, which is inert, and those who got the chelation EDTA. Unquote. Why is this being made public when it is yet to be published in a medical journal, and accordingly will have been subjected to peer review? 2 years ago, a world-renowned authority on plant proteins and nutrition, with nearly 300 reference peer-reviewed journals to his credit, was fired and treated disgracefully by his own colleagues for committing the unforgivable sin of speaking publicly about his concerns about genetically modified food safety prior to publishing his findings in a referee journal. It is therefore a double standard. That was Dr. Arpad Pusike. Now, like the New Zealand clinical trial reported in the journal Circulation in 1994, the Calgary trial purports to be a placebo-controlled. In fact, both these trials were not placebo-controlled. So what I'm going to do is show you, if you've heard the news and have been dissuaded from taking chelation therapy because of, well, there was no benefit to it according to the scientific studies, though the study in Calgary was a complete sham. It was a scientific disgrace. and should never have been published. And but to release the information before it's been reviewed carefully by people in the field shows you some of their motive. The lifestyle of Calgary's so-called placebo group were changed, including dietary changes and administration of very high doses of antioxidants like vitamin E and vitamin C. Likewise, the chelation group followed the same regimen. The only difference was EDTA administered to the chelation group. A placebo is supposed to be inert, with no therapeutic value. To be a true placebo, you do not change the protocol's person's lifestyle or affect them in any other way than administering an inert pill or an inert infusion, as the case may be. In the New Zealand study, their control group were given an infusion of vitamin C and 5B vitamins, including B1. Thiamine, along with vitamin C, are chelating agents. It was no surprise that the chelating group and the placebo group experienced 69 and 59% increase in walking capacity. Significantly, 2 years later, a letter to the editor of the New Zealand Journal of Medicine, which was May 24, 1996, pointed out that the chelated patients in the New Zealand trial were still improving. Now, the cohort of the Calgary trial amounted to 80 people whose cardiovascular symptoms were very mild to begin with. Lifestyle changes such as diet and exercise along with would have made a difference for improving the symptoms. Under these circumstances, I'm not surprised with this outcome. It'll be interesting to see what peer-reviewed journal will accept the Calgary trial for publication, since medical journals are increasingly under greater scrutiny for publishing questionable studies passed off as so-called science. Trust me, there was no science in this study. It was a disgrace. According to my sources at ACAM, the representative in Calgary objected to the way that protocol was set up for the control group, but the cardiologist insisted on the design and dismissed ACAM. Clearly, the Calgary study was designed to have a negative outcome. If chelation therapy does not work, why are there more than 56 medical doctors in Canada now offering this therapy? In 1987, there was only one chelating doctor practicing in Canada. For several years, cardiologists in the various provincial colleges of physicians and surgeons and medical associations and federal and provincial health ministers and their bureaucrats have decried the lack of scientific proof demonstrating chelation therapy to be safe and effective in the treatment of cardiovascular disease and peripheral vascular disease and diabetic neuropathy. This is justification for opposition to this modality. Ongoing harassment of physicians and interference with physicians' access to drugs and materials to administer the therapy. There have been instances involving hostile intimidation of patients by their cardiologist. The Ontario government of David Peterson passed a law to make it illegal for a licensed medical doctor to practice chelation therapy for the conditions I just mentioned. Now imagine, it's against the law to practice peripheral vascular disease, cardiovascular disease, and diabetic neuropathy, all of which, without exception, have been improved using chelation therapy. And since legalized by the Mike Harris government in the middle 1980s, a clinical trial on chelation therapy was set up by Dr. Matthews of the Roland Watson Clinic in Victoria, British Columbia, with the approval of the British Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons, and the proviso that the study was to be carried out with the cooperation of the University of Victoria. The study was funded by the patients who paid $3,000 a month to the University of Victoria Physiology Laboratory and raised some $60,000 plus the cost of a new Doppler blood pressure machine. The study started with 300 patients and 7,236 chelation treatments were given. It was proved unequivocally that EDTA chelation therapy was safe, even for patients with some kidney problems. This was the safety study to be followed by the effectiveness study. The effectiveness study began with only 40 patients allowed to take part. The number of patients was reduced to 17 when it was found some of the doctors making referrals had deliberately changed the patient's medication, thereby compromising the study results. Very few patients were referred to the second study by their doctors. Even then, there was such remarkable results that, paraphrasing the words of the clinicians, quote, they were encouraged us to proceed to this trial, unquote. Meantime, a Victoria cardiologist persuaded the Victoria University Senate to cancel the university's support of the study because it was, quote, unethical. Again, politics, money come into imbing. Mind you now, they've had two studies, one showing it was safe and one showing it was effective. Now, that's not good enough because that means that now it can be legitimized. People can benefit from it. Your doctor can use it without fear of harassment. And they can't tolerate that. So we got to keep doing it and control it, manipulate it, so that it doesn't come out positive. And so then they harassed and harangued. And then without the university support, the physicians conducting the trial had no choice but to shut it down. The College of Physicians and Surgeons claimed the study was ended by Dr. Matthews. Other correspondents suggest just the opposite. Quote, there have been difficulties with other members of the profession, unquote. The university records concerning the study were shredded, and the College of Physicians and Surgeons, when accused through Freedom of Information Act, has refused to release 44 pages, quote, containing research information of employees at the University of Victoria, unquote, from their files. This is with the full knowledge that the university claims the records have been destroyed. The college forced Dr. Matthews to personally pay out $24,000 for laboratory fees in spite of the fact that the bulk of the expenses had been paid by the patients. Was this to make sure that another chelating study would not happen in British Columbia? By 1990, in a letter addressed to the late Mr. Ted Dixon, founder and president of the EDTA Chelation Association of British Columbia, over the signature of its registrar, the College of Physicians and Surgeons had stated that doctors in British Columbia could practice chelation therapy. However, it was without the approval or endorsement of the college. Now, in the United States, clinical trials on chelation therapy have similarly been aborted. The trial at Johns Hopkins Military Hospital, Baltimore, Maryland, was discontinued because the doctors were called to the Gulf War. The study was not resumed when the war ended. The doctors were reassigned elsewhere. In 1992, it was announced that a clinical trial would be funded by American Home Products, Wythe Industry. That never got off the ground because it was canceled when company's clinical director was changed. The Office of Alternative Medicine, the U.S. National Institutes of Health, along with the American College for Advancement in Medicine, were to jointly fund a clinical trial at the University of Washington, Seattle. It was stopped at the 11th hour because of, quote, political pressure not to do it. There is evidence that the strongest opponents to chelation therapy are using every means possible to thwart clinical trials from taking place at any university. University Shenanigans Foil Chelation Study by Dr. James Carter in the Townsend Letter is a good article to read if you want backup on that. That's July 1997. It's called Censorship in Science and Medicine. Mainstream medical journals refuse to publish positive research studies of EDTA chelation for treatment of atherosclerosis, while at the same time printing poorly documented letters to the editor and editorials criticizing chelation. And this type of editorial censorship has prevented easy access to favorable research. Now, if you were to go to the scientific literature and research, and you began and ended with the Index Medicus or its electronic counterpart, Medline, you would have excluded an awful lot of positive articles. Physicians are often unaware that only 10% of the world's total biomedical literature is indexed on the Medline computer database, and many research studies have been published that support positive findings for chelation therapy, but they are not easy to find. A Medline database search will point to only 4 misleading publications. For that reason, the results of a computer search for studies of EDT chelation therapy for treatment of atherosclerosis and arteriosclerosis will be deceptively negative. Again, do not use Medline. It is political. It is controlled politically. And the AMA has its dirty little hands all over it. Its fingerprints and the Quackbuster fingerprints are easy to see. You don't need to dust it. It's there. You want to go to those that have yet been corrupted and compromised. And the government's database has always been corrupted and compromised. It's selectively does not allow articles on any topic that would challenge its prevailing view on those of the pharmaceutical industry that really pull the strings. It's the way it works. Now, unpublished positive studies on chelation therapy, we have many of those. There's in the Journal of Advancement Medicine, this randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study of EDT chelation therapy for treatment for atherosclerosis was conducted by Professor Schettler and his associates in the Clinics University Medical School of Heidelberg, Germany. And Dr. Schettler was chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine and president of the International Atherosclerosis Research Association. The study was funded by the Thiamine Pharmaceutical Company, manufacturers of the platelet inhibitor, bencyanin, and bencyclin is widely prescribed in Europe to treat atherosclerosis. EDTA chelation therapy was compared to bencyclin. It's unknown why a pharmaceutical company would fund a study of EDTA, a generic drug for which the patent had expired. It's possible that Thiamine believed mainstream propaganda that EDTA was ineffective. Why else would Thiamine out EDTA up against their own drug, a proven effective drug? Thiamine did take precautions, however. When the grant was awarded, Thiamine reserved the right in its written contract with Schettler to edit any published reports of the study. Thiamine reserved the right to interpret the final data for publication and to do the statistical analysis themselves. It was also agreed that Thiamine would retain all data at the end of the study. Such a contract seemed to eliminate the possibility of unbiased research. Well, approximately 48 patients were treated, 24 in the bencyclin group, that's the common popular drug for arteriosclerosis, and 24 in the EDTA chelation group. Treatments were given 5 days each week for a total of 4 weeks. Each patient received 20 infusions. Only patients with peripheral vascular disease could not walk 200 meters without leg pain, which is intermittent claudication caused by an atherosclerotic blockage of blood flow, were included in the study. Pain-free walking distance was measured before, during, and 3 months after the therapy on a treadmill set at 3.5 kilometers per hour with a 10% uphill gradient. The measured results showed 250% increase in distance walking before onset of claudication pain in the EDTA treated group immediately after 4 weeks of therapy. By comparison, there was only a 60% increase in the bencyclin drug group. Bencyclin, however, is a drug proven to be a benefit in this disease and is widely prescribed in Europe. 4 patients in the EDTA group experienced more than a 1,000-meter increase in pain-free walking distance. This highly favorable data from those 4 patients mysteriously disappeared when the final results were made public. Thiamine, of course, had a legal right under terms of their contract to censor and misrepresent the final results and to interpret the data in any way they suited. Their final report contained data that reduced observed benefit from EDTA immediately after the infusion from 250% increase to only 70%. The fact that data from the best EDTA responders were deleted wouldn't have been known if scientists from Heidelberg with intimate knowledge of the study had not been shocked by what they considered unethical and dishonest scientific conduct. The original raw data from the study, as described here, were personally delivered to an official of the American College of Advancement Medicine in the United States for independent analysis. Results of the Heidelberg study were reported verbally from the podium at the 7th Atherosclerotic Congress in Melbourne, Australia, in 1985. The presentation in Australia described only a 70% average increase in pain-free walking distance in the ETA chelation group instead of 250% increase indicated by the raw material, which was compared to 76% increase in the group treated with the bencyclin. Hence, the drug had a slight statistically insignificant advantage. In effect, they were both the same. The only patient deaths was in the bencyclin group, no deaths, no serious side effects were observed with EDTA. So, since both were considered equal, even though that was fraudulent, the study was, the results were contrived, the raw data is a matter of historical fact. Any scientist could review the raw data. Any biostatistician, any medical biostatistician could see that clearly it was 250% or almost five times or almost a 500% increase in chelation therapy benefit in walking and no deaths. Well, if you have, let's just argue for a moment and say, let's play devil's advocate and say, okay, the actual results were 70 versus 76. That's virtually the same. But one group, patients died and got worse. The other group, no one died, no one got worse. Well, then which one would be benefited? An attachment to the abstract of that presentation available at the meeting contained a graphic plot of pain-free walking distance extended out to 3 months after the end of therapy. When the original data from the deleted EDTA treated subjects were added back, including those with maximum relief of symptoms, average walking distance increased by more than 400% 3 months following EDTA chelation therapy. Deceptively negative interpretations of this study received widespread coverage in the news media, but results were never published in the scientific medical journal. Furthermore, press releases stated that, quote, EDTA was no better than a placebo, unquote, without mentioning that the so-called placebo was a proven effective drug. Again, God, is there no honesty anywhere in science? Is all of science just totally manipulated and controlled? Most yes. That's the reality. By way of comparison, in the study that resulted in FDA approval of Trinacol, which is the actual name for Penoxiflin, for the treatment of claudication, walking distance increased 25% over baseline. Because the number of patients was sufficiently large, that amount of improvement was statistically significant, and the FDA approved it for marketing. Well, the American College for Advancement in Medicine, ACAM, is the parent body that trains medical doctors in the correct protocol for chelation therapy, for metal toxicity as well as for vascular disease and the complications of diabetes. ACAM is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education as a sponsor of continuing medical education for physicians, their staff, and medical technicians, and evaluates the overall continuing medical education programs. So these include the American Board of Medical Specialists, the American Hospital Association, the American Medical Association, the Association of for Hospital Medical Education, the Association of American Medical Colleges, the Council for Medical Specialty Societies, and the Federation of State Medical Boards. In 2000, ACAM received an accreditation for another four-year term. Now, why is that important? Because under ACAM, every effort has been made to have a fair and objective evaluation of EDTA. Not one has occurred. And when ACAM got the original raw data and produced what was the actual statistics, mind you, they're on an equal par as far as their accreditation with the journal with the American Medical Association. Why didn't any of the major media pick up their report? Why is it that no journalist ever digs into these stories and reports the true story? The chelation therapy does work, would be saving lives, should be used. Only it now baby boomers should be using it preventatively to help them with many of the diseases they're going to be racked with if they don't in the future. We could be taking people out of nursing homes by using EDTA. Behind the scenes of the pharmaceutical industry, always aware that any competition is too much competition. And therefore, since you can't play fair, play power. And power is he who gives the money buys the little hoary politicians, and they're all hoary politicians. They're not one of them I have any respect for. They're just so reprehensible. Absolutely reprehensible. And the entire mess means that Americans are going to suffer because our media does not have the integrity or decency to report stories fairly and objectively and do their homework. Nobody wants to come up against one of those 1,400-pound bemoanus and get squashed. And you dig into that kind of story and show up that these major pharmaceuticals have been playing with statistics, excluding people who benefited from their studies, manipulating protocols, handling the data. then when will be the next time you have a study that has a chance of enlightening us and helping us? I'm Gary Nall. Let me go to another story here that's equally important. This comes from, of course, this would not come from any American paper. That would be asking too much, especially the New York Times. Couldn't find the truth if they went on a major mission for it. This is from the Sunday Express. And it's by Lucy Johnstone and Victoria Fletcher. And it says, quote, new evidence over half of autistic children has reaction to MMR vaccine. A leading scientist has produced fresh evidence that the controversial measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine could trigger autism in children. A groundbreaking study of 80 autistic children found more than half had suffered an immune reaction to the jab, meaning inoculation, which may have damaged their brains. The work, due to be published by world-renowned immunologist Dr. Vidra Singh, adds to growing concern that babies are being put at risk by the vaccine and casts fresh doubts on the government's claims that it is safe. The new research comes as a poll commissioned for the Sunday Express shows overwhelming public support for our campaign for the option of single vaccines. The survey shows that 68% of the population want to see single vaccines made available for those parents who do not want their children given the MMR multiple vaccine. In an exclusive interview with the Sunday Express, Dr. Singh of the Department of Biology, Utah State University, said the new findings were disturbing. Quote, I strongly suspect the MMR vaccine is not safe in certain children whose immune systems can't cope with it, and this is causing autism. This is a unique and disturbing finding and further illustrates that this vaccine may not be safe, unquote. The research follows his previous study, which showed that exposing some babies to measles and herpes viruses could cause their immune systems to malfunction. Keep that in mind, because a lot of babies are given vaccines where herpes is in a contaminant of the vaccine. His revelations come as medical experts condemned the government's multi-million dollar campaign to persuade a skeptical public that the MMR is safe. By the way, as an aside, that was the same government, Department of Health, that tried to claim that the cattle that were being brought into question for mad cow disease were unsafe. And instead of taking a look at the facts first, the government encouraged people to eat hamburgers. I was over there at the time. I flew over to England at the time to cover the story. And also to cover the story on some of the vaccines being used, because they were a little more advanced than we were, because they didn't have quite the same pressure on them. And their doctors were talking with me, and including some of their Harley Street doctors, which is kind of their upper level political people. And they said, I wouldn't eat the hamburger. And yet here was one of the ministers and one of the prime minister people out there chomping on a hamburger like, see, I'm eating this hamburger. Now, I don't have mad cow disease. Yeah, well, you don't know. And I remember watching a doctor at UCLA eat a teaspoon of DDT and said, see, there's no harm in DDT. You could eat it. Mm-hmm. Well, we banned DDT after it was shown to be one of the most devastating chemicals ever created. What would have happened if a small group of us, and it was just a small group, had not spent 15 years fighting to have DDT banned? How many people would have died? How many miscarriages? How many people suffering rare brain disorders and autoimmune conditions? All because of the arrogance and ego of one of the scientists at UCLA. So these very people over there were telling people, don't worry about the MMR vaccine, but they're the same people who said, don't worry about atomic energy test. Even though we denied it, we flew plane loads of disabled people over and put them right in an island where they were going to be exposed to nuclear radiation, and none of them came back, and we didn't tell anyone we hit it. I wouldn't believe anything the British government said about anything, ever. I wouldn't even believe if they told us the Queen died. How would they know anyhow? Jackie Fleischer, founder and pressure group JABS, which is campaigning for single vaccines to be available, said, we have parents who are so desperate to get single vaccines, they are traveling to other countries or paying extortionate prices to private doctors. The government says there is an epidemic on the doorstep because children aren't being inoculated. Why on earth didn't they give us a choice? Well, what I would say to Jackie Fletcher is, Jackie, don't trust the government. If they're saying that there's an epidemic on your doorstep, ask them, epidemic? How's that possible when 90% of all the children have been fully vaccinated? If you're saying that after being fully vaccinated, there's an epidemic for those children who are fully vaccinated, then what then is the value of saying the vaccine was efficacious in preventing future disease? What we're seeing is that we're having high incidence of disease for what the children were inoculated with. If they would go to my report, GaryNull.com, look under vaccines, you will see the actual study showing that there has never been a vaccine, never, that can be proven safe and effective for any individual using it. And if anyone in this audience would like to challenge that, please do show me the vaccine and show me a statement. And I would like to see a statement from anyone in this audience, any physician, public health official, who will state that I guarantee that if I give this vaccine, this hepatitis vaccine to this surgeon, hepatitis vaccine to this nurse, that they will never get hepatitis. And if they do, I will pay their damages. Let's see that statement. I'd like to see it. And let's see the scientific article that will prove you can prevent a disease in a given person. So they're concerned about the MMR. I'm concerned about all vaccines. Instead of allowing things to be done in a way that encourages the immune system. This comes from Sharon Laferrere, Mary Pat Flattery, and Joe Stevens from the Washington Post staff writers. And it's called an article, The Dilemma, Submit or Suffer. Uninformed consent is rising, ethic of the drug test boom. I'll quote it here. Estonia, Pärnu, Estonia. Kelder, a 27-year-old accountant, thought he was being recruited for a test of some kind of vitamin. It seemed like a great idea. Free air tickets to Switzerland, 2 weeks at a conference clinic, a comfortable clinic, and a cash stipend of several hundred dollars, more than a typical monthly salary in the struggling Baltic region. In October 1998, he jetted to Basel, a pristine mountain town of flower boxes and church spires, expecting a transfer to a 3-star hotel. Instead, he found himself in a sterile clinic filled with beds, where he would be tested for a drug whose risks and purposes he did not understand. He said he wanted to back out, then realized it was dark. The airport was an hour away, and he had no obvious alternative. Eventually, he signed a consent form written in German, a language he could not read. When he finally got an English translation, he said the clinic doctor agreed only to show him a copy. Kelder said he had no idea what tablets he swallowed during the next 2 weeks. Maybe it was written between all this mumbo-jumbo, he said. His countryman, Petrami, arrived in Basel in January 1999, knowing almost nothing about the drug he was to take, and left there after 3 weeks just as ignorant. Quote, they told me something about skin disease, said the 20-year-old. All these forms, and we didn't get any copies. I didn't like it. But when we were already there, it was too late to change our minds. The clinic at which Kelder and Petrami stayed ultimately shut down after authorities discovered that its operator, Van Tex Research, had filled many of its beds with people who didn't know they were in experiments, refugees seeking political asylum in Switzerland, and drug addicts. It had performed 161 drug trials for some of the world's best-known pharmaceutical companies. A Swiss prosecutor is investigating fraud charges. The case was, quote, the most unpleasant experience ever in the short history of clinical trials in Estonia, unquote, said an Estonian medical regulator. The violations uncovered in the Van Tex case point to wider failures with patient consent procedures that some doctors and researchers say will increasingly occur at drug companies staging human tests in far-flung countries using naive, impoverished, or uneducated patients. Participants in human drug experiments are supposed to be fully informed of the risks they face during a test. The principle of informed consent lies at the heart of human drug testing contained in guidelines widely endorsed around the world. These rules ban coercion and trickery and give patients the right to withdraw from the test at any time for any reason. But researchers and doctors say these principles have been breaking down as drug companies enroll thousands of test subjects at a time in Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, Africa, China, Latin America, and elsewhere. In some cases, unscrupulous operators just ignore the rules. In other instances, the problems are more complex, involving such questions as whether an illiterate third world villager who knows little about modern medicine can give informed consent in a way comparable to a Western patient. Visits by Washington Post reporters to foreign test sites, as well as inspections and surveys of drug experiments overseas by various regulators and medical researchers, provided indications of widespread lapses. A recent survey by two Johns Hopkins University researchers of more than 500 U.S. and foreign investigators found that most thought consent procedures and experiments were mainly used to shield researchers from lawsuits rather than protect patients. Inspections of foreign drug test sites by the Western Institutional Review Board, a for-profit U.S.-based ethics committee that approves drug research protocols, revealed breakdowns in the process. Quote, many, many times what we find at the site is a very abbreviated version of the consent form with approval, unquote. Catholic University's Medical School in Santiago, Chile, surveyed 44 clinical trials in that country 4 years ago and found, quote, ethical problems in 20 of the 44. The most common failing was inadequate consent of test participants or no consent at all. Now, here are my thoughts on this. There's a deeper issue, and that is that we continue to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on the search for the next Viagra, the search for the next antibiotic. When you take a person in a third world country who is impoverished, and Soviet Union now is a third world country, and you give them a chance to make some money and you feed them, how likely is it that they're going to think of any long-term effect that a drug may have in their system? There is never a detailed discussion of the drugs being tested, and there is no long-term follow-up. In fact, there is almost no follow-up. Whatever happens has to be seen in a relatively short period of time. The trouble with the immune system is that if you are inoculating someone with something, if you're giving them a drug, you could have a latent period, and it might be 6 months or a year or 2 years before it really impacts upon the person's immune system. The idea that every one of these thousands of drug tests going around the world are all contained within 1 to 3 weeks is absurd. We have seen how exposure at one point in life to a single X-ray can cause cancer 50 years later. That's from a single X-ray. Dr. John Goffman, who I've interviewed for an upcoming documentary I'm doing on low-level radiation, he's an MD, PhD, and arguably the greatest mind we have in the dangers of X-rays, said there is no such thing as a safe X-ray. A single X-ray at any time in your life could cause cancer. When you start looking at the epidemic of cancer we have faced in the last 20 years, it's not difficult to see that our parents were exposed to diagnostic X-rays with unreliable equipment for routine procedures. Many people were automatically given an annual chest X-ray. And it had nothing to do with determining did they have tuberculosis. It had to do with defensive medicine, where people were on a cookbook protocol. Nobody looked to see, was it reasonable? Was it right? Should have been changed. Well, if you've had a chest X-ray for 20, 25, or 30 years, and kids in New York State, for instance, but between the ages of 1 and 2, for got 24 monthly fluoroscopes. And a fluoroscope, the way they were looking back then, you could give equivalent to 100 chest X-rays with one fluoroscopic examination because there was no limit of time that they would keep you there and looking around inside your body. And it was all kind of amazing and new. No different than when you used to walk into a shoe store, and it was before I was born, but my mother certainly told me about it. And I actually saw some stores, older stores in a small town that actually still had them. You could put your feet in a box and it was X-rayed and they would show your bones. And that was one way they thought they could better determine the size of your shoe that you should have based upon the bones. It was all some stupid thing. But that went on for 35 to 40 years. Every time you get a pair of shoes, you're getting an x-ray. And again, standing in one of those boxes looking down at your feet, you could sit there for, you know, half a minute or a minute and look. That's equivalent to an x-ray going off every millisecond. You could get 1,000 x-ray exposures. Gee whiz, you know, 20 years later, a person ends up with lung cancer, ends up with some other cancer. So here we're exposing all these people around the world to tests and no follow-up whatsoever. None. So what if any of the things they're putting in their body could be infective? Well, we could be starting problems, and no one seems to care. But then again, we haven't even cared about our Gulf War vets. We didn't care about the Vietnam vets when they came back, either physically or psychologically. You can't turn someone into a killing machine who will kill upon orders. The only way you can do that is first you have to take all the things that they valued that were sacred, and you have to terrorize that and beat it out of them. Much like a Manchurian candidate, and we pride ourselves in how tough we become. Well, after all that toughness is used in battle, what do you do to de-toughenize that person? What do you do to bring back their compassion and sensitivity? There was no program. People had to do it on their own. Some succeeded in doing it on their own. Others didn't. Hundreds of thousands ended up basket cases because of the stress of how you cope in a society that is no longer militaristic, no longer, you know, no longer requiring the same adrenaline or same orders. You can't just decommission people and assume because they're out of the service they're all back and normal again. It doesn't work that way. I had friends who I saw destroy themselves and their families because they could not readjust. One of my buddies, in fact, I went to high school with, came back from Vietnam, and man, he was just fighting everybody. And one night I was talking with him. We went out, and I said, "What's going on? You know, why are you always on edge?" And he said, "It's just something that he got over there, and he got into it, and he both burned out on it, and now he didn't know how to rebalance, so everything ticked him off, and he just couldn't fight with anyone." Well, he committed suicide. Now that's too many of those. So what happens when you put someone on something and you don't take a look, see what happens, and 20 years from now they end up with the disease? Pharmaceutical companies are notorious for being irresponsible. They've never come out and really admitted any of their mistakes. They have to be forced into admitting them through legislation or through lawsuits. So I suggest that we start looking at, do we need another medicine in order to have a healthier society? Clearly the answer is no. But we're not putting any money into prevention. None. And even in the pittance that they call prevention, it's not real prevention. It's drugs as prevention, like tamoxifen for cancer. And now they have the morning after pill for people who may think they were exposed to someone with AIDS. Well, that morning after pill, that is not a birth control pill, and it is not a viral control pill. That is a very strong protease inhibitor antiretroviral cocktail, and that can destroy a person's immune system. So that's my thought on that. I'm Gary Knoll. Before I get back to some other stories here, which I also think are important, let's just take a few calls and let's ask Michael if we have anyone on the line. Michael, is anyone on our line?
We have a few callers calling in, Gary.
Okay, let's take some of those calls. We're only taking calls from the tri-state New York area today. 212-209-2900. And let's see who we have up now. What's your name, please? You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
You have said that somebody should always take a buffered form of vitamin C. I was wondering, what's wrong with taking powdered pure ascorbic acid? And if someone does take a buffered form, wouldn't that upset the calcium-magnesium balance? And the third part of that question is, if they take pure ascorbic acid, would that disturb the acid alkalinity balance in the bottle, in the body?
Three good questions. Thank you for asking them. Let's address them. Linus Pauling took pure ascorbic acid, and he was able to take between 18 to 20,000 milligrams a day. He and I had many discussions on this. And I offered a different point of view. In fact, I had done studies on vitamin C at the Institute of Applied Biology and on tissue absorption. And I took a group of individuals of all different backgrounds and found that those who were had normal pH in the stomach, by pure ascorbic acid, they generally reached acid intolerance at about a fourth of the way before they'd reach bowel tolerance. And that is because straight ascorbic acid creates a hyperacidic environment in the stomach itself. Hence the bloating, the gas, and the and diarrhea in some cases. So by the time that ascorbic acid gets into the intestine, which is not acid but is alkaline, it generally causes a speeded up peristalsis, the wave-like rhythmic movement of the intestine, and that creates the diarrhea. It also has a diuretic effect. So people tend to dehydrate. By using a buffering agent and calcium from citrate, or calcium from chelate, magnesium from aspartate, citrate, or chelate are all natural buffering agents. And what these do, these allow the calcium ascorbate, which is a calcium-bound ascorbate, which is the form of vitamin C that is actually used by your tissue. Your tissue does not use ascorbic acid. It has to be changed into ascorbate. And it's in the ascorbate form the body actually absorbs it. So by, in effect, allowing one-step conversion towards its natural bioavailability, you do not hit that stomach acid intolerance. You can go much further, and you generally don't hit the stomach acid intolerance. You'll hit a bowel acid tolerance, and that's generally about four times more. And what I did was I took a group of individuals who were taking vitamin C, and I gave them three types of vitamin C. Vitamin C from straight ascorbic acid, vitamin C from buffered vitamin C, and vitamin C with bioflavonoids. And the bioflavonoids were hesperidin, rutin, and quercetin. Now, the bioflavonoids represented 20% of the amount of the vitamin C itself. Over a period of 6 weeks, taking the vitamin C the first week once a day, the second week twice a day, and then building it up until they were finally taking it six times a day, the straight ascorbic acid group, at the level they started, which was 1,000 milligrams, over half the people hit bowel tolerance just with straight ascorbic acid, just with 1,000 milligrams in a single dose in the first week. None were able to do it by the fourth week. None of them that were taking straight ascorbic acid, because it does change pH. Those taking the buffered form of vitamin C were able to do it clear through. The difference was those taking it with bioflavonoids had the easiest time of it, where there was no adverse effects whatsoever. And they also gave back reports such as bruises had healed with the bioflavonoids, because vitamin P, which is bioflavonoids, must be available for vitamin C to make its conversion to be biologically active. And this is why taking things in combination as they appear in nature is much better than taking them as an isolate. Isolates can work, but they can also create imbalance. You never find ascorbic acid by itself in nature. It just doesn't happen. You always find it as a mix. And in that mixture, you find phytochemicals. So by taking it in the form of a juice where you had other phytochemicals, upwards of 500 different phytochemicals, phyto meaning plant-based chemicals, you get the greatest healing power. In fact, and that's the scientific basis of it. And I wrote an article on that, which is on my webpage. Go under GaryNoll.com, look under vitamin C, and I wrote it also published in the Townsend Letter for Doctors. I also wrote an article on this some years back for the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, also published one in the Journal of Pharmacology. I was about to give a lecture, and it was to be an all-day workshop. And one of the guys was in the front row. And out of the clear blue, he starts this whole, you know, discussion about, well, vitamin C. And I didn't know, but he was a sales representative for a vitamin C that was one of these kind of little fizzies, you know, kind of effervescence in the water, which is a gimmick, doesn't do anything. It's, you know, even if you've heard some doctors promoting it, they're getting a They're paid spokespersons. Anyhow, I said, well, how about a challenge? How about I always take some vitamin C because I'm not going to eat all day today because I'm going to drink juices. You have some of yours? Yeah. All right. Well, let's take equal amounts. And I won't leave the stage, but you can't leave your seat. He's all right. So he came up. I had a big quart of juice, and I divided it in half. And I started off. I said, all right, let's start with 5,000 milligrams. And every hour, we'll go up 5,000 more milligrams. And I took my, I drank it down. He drank his down. About 20 minutes later, I'm watching him, man. He is doing this shuffling of the legs, and you could hear his, cheeks coming together like two vices. It was funny. So the second hour, and he didn't make it through the first hour. Second hour, in fact, what was hilarious, he didn't come back. I hope he didn't get flushed away. But I just kept, I thought it'd be kind of fun. And then I was just curious for myself. So I just started taking 5,000 every hour. And I took over 45,000. I think all total was 50,000 milligrams. No problem. There was a doctor in New York who will not be named. And he called me one day. And he said, I've got a real problem. I've got to be on television in 2 days. And I wake up this morning like this humongous infection in my eye. And he had been swimming in the ocean and down on the Jersey Shore. And so I said, all right. I went over and I took a look and I gave him a suggestion. I said, you're going to have to take it up to bowel tolerance. Well, he had a bunch of vitamin C on his, and it was buffered. And he poured in just one afternoon 65,000 milligrams of vitamin C. I was there. I saw it. No bowel tolerance. And the next day's eye was clear. I had read the work of Dr. Frederick Klenner from North Carolina, who was the first American physician to use vitamin C intravenous at high doses. Everyone else after him, including Dr. Cathcart, learned from him. But his high dose, his maxi high dose, was 50,000 milligrams. And when I was working with some people who had full-blown AIDS, and we're talking about full-blown AIDS, one guy had 22 of 30 opportunistic infections and had been in the hospital, St. Vincent's Hospital, and was dying. I saw the 50,000 milligrams was not going to make a difference. We went up to 200,000 milligrams daily. And in under 2 weeks, his body was starting a major change. Of course, there were other things in the protocol as well, and other things within the vitamin C drip as well. But I started asking the doctor, I said, can you do a urine analysis? I'd like to see how much vitamin C he's passing. Because the old myth is, well, any vitamin C you don't use is going to be passed in the urine. And I'm thinking there is an innate intelligence that knows how much vitamin C to take into a diseased tissue. And since the body realizes vitamin C is a major component to its immune challenge on antiviral and antibacterial, I'll bet it's going to be using it. And sure enough, almost no vitamin C was passing in his urine. That meant that his body was using 200,000 milligrams a day. Whereas had he been ideally healthy, he had hit a level where the body no longer required it, and it had passed. All this means that we're dealing with more than just a inert object. We're dealing with a dynamic living presence, a consciousness within the tissue, the mind that exceeds the brain, that knows what it needs. And this is something science has yet to appreciate. And that's why it looks for what can benefit it. And then when you start flooding the body with those phytochemicals along with the vitamin C, that's when you get the greatest benefit. So don't use ascorbic acid by itself. If you're going to use it in buffered form, and use it in buffered form with bioflavonoids. If you're going to use it with buffered and bioflavonoids, take one more step and use it with phytochemicals, juices. By using it with chlorophyll-rich juices, you're enhancing the detoxification and stimulating healthy liver enzymes, which allow greater expulsion of toxins out of the body. By using it with fruits, you're allowing the body to have greater viral antiviral activity, which will help you with herpes, hepatitis, cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, Coxsackie virus, the things that can hurt you and do. And do not be dissuaded by the fact that you may have had some diarrhea or upset stomach in the past. You have to gradually build up your tolerance. We'll take another call. Your turn. What's your name, please? You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Gary. Thanks for taking the call. I had a question. Some years back, Epstein-Barr and cytomegalovirus were detected in my blood. I haven't had any kind of effects from that. Do I need to be concerned?
Yes. The fact you've had no effects is only means that your body at this time is able to hold its own, but always going down. And the going down is in direct relationship to the amount of chronic and acute stress, environmental stress, and your overall body's immune modulation process. So if you're eating really good and you're drinking lots of juices and lots of healthy water and you're getting adequate rest and you're dealing more appropriately with stress, then it will take longer for those viruses to manifest. But make no mistake, there is no such thing as a non-objectionable virus when it comes to these viruses. These viruses are there as unwelcome guests. When you go through a stress, then they'll start to manifest, and their titers rise. As the titers rise, you end up with either a cold, a flu, congestion in the lungs, infected sinus cavities, wounds that don't heal properly, and you'll start to see it in your skin as well. So start a good quality cleansing program and then an antiviral program. And the best antiviral program there is ozone. Intravenous ozone will knock out more viruses than anything else, but there's a specific protocol. I am out of the city. I'm out helping very important causes, so I'm not there. If you call, I don't even know the doctor's name, call the Metropolitan Wellness Center. They're over on the, I think they're on East 26th Street, I believe, and ask for, because I gave them a whole bunch of my protocols. I've given thousands of doctors, thousands, every day of the week, anywhere from 5 to 10 doctors from around the country, Orthodox doctors, call and ask for different protocols, and I'll give them protocols, and they call me and ask for advice on nutrition and all this other stuff, and I give it. But, so that's one place at least you can call. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I'll be back tomorrow sharing more on the subject of health and nutrition. Have a nice day, everyone.